Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
Richard Nixon was under a lot of stress in 1971. The Black Panthers wanted him dead, government buildings were under attack by anti-war radicals, and the counterculture had taken over. It seemed like America's youth were all on drugs, and Nixon's effort to stop that looked pretty weak. The guy needed a victory, and at that point, even a symbolic one would do. Enter Timothy Leary, the ideal bad guy, Nixon thought, to the president's good guy. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The person Nixon declared the most dangerous man in America was an unlikely public enemy. Leary was closing in on 50 years old, and although he encouraged experimentation with drugs, he wasn't some kingpin. He was a former Harvard psychology professor who had been given a 10-year sentence for possession of two joints. But he'd been busted out of prison 6 months into his term and managed to slip out of the country, where he had hooked up with Nixon's other nemesis, Black Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver. What followed is a series of events too bizarre to be fiction. Bill Minutaglio and his research partner and co-author Stephen L. Davis tell this story, complete with newly declassified information in their new book. It's called The Most Dangerous Man in America: Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. Bill, welcome back to Think.
I'm really glad to be here.
I love this story because it's completely unbelievable and completely true. Like, if on paper you cherry-pick the facts of Leary's early life,
right.
Grew up Catholic, appointed to West Point, decorated World War II veteran, he would not have seemed like the guy who would become the poster child for the counterculture.
Yeah, it's kind of a cliche, but you know, the unlikely story makes for the best story. In our acknowledgments in the book, among the last pages, the first line says, "Thank you to Timothy Leary for leading such an interesting life."
So you actually met him in the 80s.
Yeah.
What was he like to sit down and talk with? Was he self-absorbed?
You know, he really wasn't. It was a rainy afternoon in Houston, Texas. I don't know what this says about me. We elected to meet in a bar, or what it says about him. But there's an old place that some listeners might know in Houston called La Carafe. Some people call it the oldest bar, maybe in the oldest building in Houston. It happened to be downtown. It seemed like a good, quiet place to meet. And it was a rainy afternoon, and we talked probably for 4 or 5 hours. And I found him, incredibly charismatic, extremely intelligent. In retrospect, quite visionary. In conversation, he was talking to me about the possibility, this is in the early 80s, when people might communicate through some globally connected computer network, which I think, some people say Al Gore later took credit for, called the internet. And then we would also communicate with the small handheld portable computers, smartphones. He's an extremely prescient. I had no idea what he was talking about, then, by the way.
It's like, as you're jotting it down.
It was like, how unlikely. Yeah, right. Note to self, invest in Apple. But he was extremely charismatic, very witty. I had a feeling, when I was talking to him, and I don't know if it was just the sort of the aura that he had. And I grew up in a time period when Timothy Leary was sort of a hero for many and an extreme villain for others. That was one of the attractions in doing the book. But I had a feeling that he was very much in the moment, chatting with me, and it was sort of like a guy you'd meet in a bar. I've compared him to kind of an interesting Irish priest, somebody you just might meet at a pub who would just talk about St. Augustine and talk about philosophy. But I also had the feeling that he was maybe psychoanalyzing me. I just every once in a while had that feeling that he was in the moment but hovering above it and trying to make sense of me as well. I did write in the book, or we wrote in the book, my great colleague Steve Davis and I wrote that when I had met him, he was still trying to sort out what had happened to him in his life, and in particular, the circumstances in our book. So he was very funny, very approachable, had a sort of an existential sense of humor, I'd say.
For people who don't know Timothy Leary from Dennis Leary, the actor, right. we should get a little bit of background.
Sure, yeah.
He was had a deep interest in psychotropics, but he had a background in psychology.
Yeah.
What did he think those drugs, initially, what did he think those drugs could do for people who were suffering from mental illness?
Yeah, he thought it would be a palliative, you know, a gateway to a cure, a treatment, at least. One of his main concerns... when he first really got started in earnest, this was at UC Berkeley, where he had done some studies and then kind of advanced his work. He had heard about psilocybin and
mushrooms.
Exactly, magic mushrooms. He had gone down to Mexico to kind of investigate and, you know, returned from saying that he learned more in the few hours of his encounter with magic mushrooms than he had in all of his many years pursuing his doctorate and then even later on teaching at Harvard. But early on, he was looking for ways to help people, and in particular, in a very focused way, he was looking at how to reduce recidivism among prisoners in California, people who would be repeat criminal offenders, you know, folks who would go back to prison, frankly, for the same crimes that they had not been rehabilitated for while in prison.
I want to put in an irony alert here, by the way. Please
continue. Yeah, exactly. I think I know where you're headed. But he was doing extremely controlled experiments, quantifiable types of experiments. It was not random. He wasn't handing out LSD to people willy-nilly. He was doing, you know, very, you know, quantitative chemical experiments, if you will. He became convinced of the thought that, I guess it was in the notion of, you know, physician, heal thyself, or physician, know what it is that you're prescribing. He began looking into LSD himself and figured that, well, it seems pretty simple in a sense, though probably ultimately very complex, that if I'm giving this powerful substance out to people, which was legal at the time, by the way.
Or not illegal.
Not illegal. Yeah. Good point. Exactly. Yeah. In the late 50s and early 60s, that he should start trying some LSD. And he was a great believer early on in two things. He called it set and setting, that you be in the right mindset to consume a powerful drug. But that you also be in the right setting, that it be a controlled setting, a monitored setting.
Safe place.
Yeah, a safe place, that you have a guide. And even at the early, at the outset, it wasn't so much, you know, kind of a spiritual, you know, hippie-esque guide, but really a scientist, someone, a chemist, who would really sort of guide you through the reactions and study what had happened to you, and then be there to take care of you in case things went a little haywire and you didn't respond in a positive way. So very controlled experiments, and, you know, he was flying way under the radar at this point. He was doing this work. The government wasn't really interested in him. But word began to seek, kind of eke out that there was a professor doing something interesting, and it eked out, I guess, around the margins. People who I would broadly call seekers, people who thought, you know, maybe there was a pill, maybe there was a shortcut to enlightenment, to nirvana, to understanding. Something bigger and more cosmic began hearing about his work and then approaching him. And that's where things get a little murky and controversial. Some folks say that Tim Leary was really responsible for kickstarting a cornerstone of the, you know, the counterculture, which was the experimenting with drugs.
How did he get such a hefty sentence for two joints?
Well, this goes back to really the opening pages of our book. You know, Nixon, as you so wonderfully said, was a very complicated president. I don't think that's a great political insight, but he was very complicated and worried. And I think ultimately deemed to be, I think, by folks on both sides of the aisle, somewhat paranoid. Nixon and his advisors were trying to figure out how to deal with swooning approval ratings. This nettlesome war in Vietnam just wouldn't go away. And frankly, conflagration, in the streets of America. Buildings were being bombed. Students were protesting quite aggressively. Groups like the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground were seeming to pose a real threat to the White House. And just law and order to the establishment. We came across, this is, I think, one of the things we pat ourselves on the back for, Steve and I, my brilliant co-author and I, think that we discovered something that had kind of been overlooked. We came across a White House tape, a secret White House tape that Nixon had conducted among his many secret White House tapes, one in which he identifies Leary or suggests that he and his team need to find really a diversion, a distraction. Is there some way to demonize an individual and make him into public enemy number one? And they settled on Tim Leary. And it was actually a rather bizarre moment for me. I was sitting in my home office in Austin just listening for hours and hours and hours. I probably need some cult deprogramming, I think, from listening to hours of White House secret Richard Nixon White House tapes. And then suddenly hearing Nixon, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Treasury Secretary John Connolly, our former governor, of course, in Texas, begin shouting out, almost chanting the name Leary, 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 Timothy Leary, Timothy Leary. And Connolly was saying, our plan should be to demonize someone to kind of divert attention away from all these problems you're experiencing. And if we can get the American people focused on a bad guy, and you can get that bad guy and put him away, then you'll be a hero and people will forget all these other things. And Nixon, you could just feel his enthusiasm and probably a smile crossing his face because he shouts out, "We've got room in the prisons for Leary." And thus it began. And we tried to establish with a lot of rigorous research that there was a coordinated plan coming all the way from the Oval Office to bust him. So he was facing, as you said, 10 years in jail for two joints, really smoked down to the nub joints that some people say were planted in his car. It was also only part of a bigger plan. He was facing charges here in Texas.
Something at the border. Right?
Yeah. He was continuing his experiments in looking at, wanting to go back to Mexico to look at magic mushrooms again. And so coming across the border, lo and behold, the gendarmes, the folks, the police officials down there found some pot on Leary and his family. And then he was also facing a host of charges back in New York State, ones that were being lodged against him by another infamous figure, G. Gordon Liddy, who was a New York State prosecutor in the early part of the 60s and had made it his own mission, even before Nixon asked him to get Tim Leary. So he had a bunch of, he had many, many decades behind bars awaiting him. And it was pretty clear in a lot of research, even inside the White House, that the plan was to put Tim Leary away until he died behind bars.
Because, of course, he had escaped. And the way he got out of prison, I mean, he was pretty fit, but he's like a 50-year-old dude. Like,
yeah, right.
It's just... It's extraordinary that he was able to get away, even from a minimum security facility.
Yeah, I'm tempted to make a joke. He was an early proponent of yoga. This is before yoga became very cool in 1970. So he was limber, but to be serious, he was a 50-year-old man and a Harvard professor. Really, if you had to stack up all the prisoners that were in the same facility as him in a state prison in California, he would be the least likely person on your list of folks to break out of prison. There were members of the Black Panther Party, people who had been more activist, let's say, in terms of their resistance to government oversight. And yeah, Tim managed to escape. His escape itself is probably worth a book all by itself.
Well, we'll take a break here and hear about that in just a minute. My guest is author Bill Minutaglio. His new book is The Most Dangerous Man in America: Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
I'm in the unfortunate position of being about 20 years ahead of my time. Now, whenever you're 20 years ahead of your time, you're in a risky position, because it always takes one generation for a new form of energy to be accepted. You know, when the airplane came along 20, 30 years ago, the older generation, to a man, said, "They'll never get me up there. I don't want to get high." The next generation, everyone's flying around in airplanes. The same thing is true with these new psychedelic drugs. And I'll say to your viewers, within 10 or 15 years, psychochemicals which expand consciousness and accelerate the mind and open up the wisdom that's inside will be just as common as books are today. And when your kid comes home from school, you won't say to him, "What book did you read today?" You'll say, "Which molecule did you use to open up which Smithsonian Institute or which Library of Congress exists inside your own mind?"
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was Timothy Leary talking to Merv Griffin in 1966. My guest this hour is author Bill Minutaglio, who, along with Stephen L. Davis, has a new book out called The Most Dangerous Man in America: Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. I don't think it was 10 or 15 years later that kids came home and said, "Here's the drug I use." But he was certainly prescient in some ways. I want to get back to how he got out of prison, because it's a bizarre story. His wife helped.
Sure.
Weather Underground helped. So pick it up from there.
Yeah, it was a convergence of really interesting forces, a marriage, if you will, of what some people back then called dope and dynamite. Tim was in jail, in prison in California, I guess under the aegis of then Governor Ronald Reagan, who was also hell-bent in making sure that Tim would never get out, along with, you know, President Richard Nixon. So he was there for 10 years, but the assumption again was that they could stack up other charges against him. And Tim had a lot of supporters, but a lot of people as well who thought of him as a bit of a pawn in a giant, giant political game going on, and that being really an attempt to overthrow the government of the United States. There were people who really felt that could happen, that that really could happen, blows against the empire. It seems maybe unlikely today, but there was a sense that forces could coalesce. So here's Tim Leary, who was extraordinarily famous, extraordinarily charismatic. He'd been on the cover of all the magazines, the news weeklies, and we just heard the clip from Merv Griffin, and he was really out there in terms of public exposure. A lot of people deemed him to be the godfather of the counterculture. And he had this aura about him. He was a Harvard professor. He's extremely charismatic, extremely well-spoken, and he could really out-debate anybody out there. So very, very dangerous from a lot of perspectives. We called him in the book the Robespierre of acid. So an intellectual and a visionary who was advocating a real deep unraveling of whatever remained from sort of the Norman Rockwell 1950s you know, sense of what America could be. So he's in prison, and people are saying we need to get him out, one, because we love him, but two, I think he could further the revolution. Tim Leary behind bars serves us no good. So a disparate trio got together, that being the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, which were at the time probably the most active and even violent some people call them a domestic terrorist group. Others would say they were student revolutionaries. They were in the act of bombing buildings all around the country, ROTC centers, university campuses, government research facilities. They had designs of maybe blowing up the Pentagon. Student activists who had gone underground and were attempting to overthrow the government and really believed they could. They were big fans of Tim from a practical perspective. They thought if they could spring the spiritual godfather of the counterculture, somebody who legitimately could claim to have millions of followers, people who liked his advocacy of Tim's famous slogan was turn on, tune in, and drop out, that if they can get him aboard, they could inspire maybe the hippie wing of things to join the revolution, to become more activist. The Black Panthers kind of felt the same way. And then what we learned was that there was this other group of folks who were more benign. They were sort of an organized collective of hippies in Southern California who had a really cool name, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. I think a little bit lost to history and underappreciated in terms of their dynamic. Those who are critics of them, they're a bunch of kind of surfers and beach rats from Southern California who began smuggling drugs and smoking a lot of pot and doing a lot of acid back in the 60s. They got a little organized, and the government began to perceive them as a threat and call them the biggest drug cartel in American soil. And they had identified Tim Leary as sort of a guru, a mentor, a savant, someone whom they would follow and try to help. They happen to have a lot of money because they were very successful at their hashish and smuggling operations, at least smuggle hashish inside surfboards into Southern California. And then they opened up Orange Sunshine LSD production labs and made millions and millions of hits of LSD. These three groups, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, the Black Panthers, and the Weather Underground, basically coalesced and said, let's get Timothy Leary out of prison. One, we really regard him, you know, very highly as a leader and as a provoker of interesting thought and cosmic revolution, but as well, maybe he can be the guy that would jumpstart the revolution by bringing in, you know, millions of other couch potato hippies who would rather be, you know, tripping out and smoking pot and not be as politically inclined. And the message got to Tim in prison, we'd like to get you out. And Tim was in prison. He was 50 years old, as you've noted, and could really see his mortality, that there was a plan. It was a very coordinated and specific plan to keep him in prison until he died. And his wife came to him one day in prison and said, essentially, you're not going to believe this. The Black Panthers, Weather Underground, and your old hippie pals, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, have a plan. We're going to get you out. It's going to involve something rather dramatic, and I probably shouldn't go into the details. Maybe there'll be one or two people who might want to read the book, but it's just extraordinarily unlikely. He had to basically go past armed guards, people that were patrolling a prison with your requisite, you know, 12, 15-foot high razor wire fence, armed guards patrolling the perimeter, and then run into the night in Central California, hoping and praying that he hadn't been punked or fooled or tricked into something, and basically hide in the bushes at the side of a highway in California waiting for someone to pick him up. He was told there would be a car that would come and get him, and that it would flash its lights at the side of the road. And when Tim saw this car, he just jumped in the back, and it turned out to be the masterminds, the leaders of the Weather Underground, who at the time were the most wanted fugitives in America. And then, you know, that was a fairly surreal moment in his life, but it just got more surreal because they had created a plan to change his identity and then smuggle him out of the United States, which they successfully did.
So he ends up in Algeria, which is a kind of outpost right. for the Black Panthers. And Eldridge Cleaver, it's an understatement to say it was an uneasy partnership from the beginning. What were Cleaver's objections to Tim Leary?
Eldridge Cleaver, you know, one of the co-founders and sort of intellectual lights of the Black Panther Party, the author of the seminal book Soul on Ice, had escaped and established what was called the Black Panther Embassy in Algeria, in North Africa. And it's an amazing turn of events as well that the Algerian government recognized the Black Panthers and the Black Panther Embassy as the true legitimate political representatives of the United States, not Richard Nixon's ambassador or anyone else affiliated, you know, with the Nixon White House, but the Black Panthers. So the Black Panthers, quote, had an embassy there where they would host, you know, foreign dignitaries, mainly from communist countries, North Korea and China and so on. And the plan was, the Weather Underground was really instrumental in this. They changed Tim's identity and the identity of his wife. They secured fake passports, smuggled him out of the country. It seems almost impossible, given, you know, post-9/11 realities at an airport today. But Tim found himself in North Africa, and the idea was that this really would be the fruition of this dope and dynamite marriage. Tim Leary, King Pied Piper of the hippies, the cosmic LSD guru, would now be meeting up with the hardcore Eldridge Cleaver-led Panthers, and together they would create this amazing outpost that people would flock to from around the world, but also where the revolution to overthrow what Cleaver called Babylon, that being the United States, or America with a K, the letter K instead of the letter C, that from this outpost and this marriage of dope and dynamite with Leary's followers, with the Black Panthers, that they would create a plan to overthrow the U.S. Unfortunately, things didn't go very well. It was a bit of it's an understatement, an oil and water mix. Tim, and I think this is to his credit, was not prone to revolution in the violent sense of that term. He was really about a revolution of the mind. I don't, if I sound a little like a fanboy here, forgive me, but I think, you know, a careful study of his philosophy and where he was headed, his revolution was one of spirit and consciousness and sort of a cosmic connectedness, and it wasn't about taking, you know, guns and weapons to the street and trying to affect change that way. So it just wasn't working out. Eldridge Cleaver, in a sense, kept Tim hostage, and Tim began thinking, wow, I was held hostage by Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan in a prison. These guys just wanted to demonize me and then put me away forever until I just died in prison. And now Eldridge Cleaver kind of wants to keep me under wraps or tamp down my more spiritual, the spiritual odysseys that I'm advocating, and is faulting me for not being, you know, gun-toting revolutionary. So it became really, really uncomfortable for Tim to the point where he was under house arrest. And then he decided, I need to make another prison break. I need to flee from here. The story gets so, you know, wacky in a way. He began trying to figure out how to communicate with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones, saying, can you guys send a boat? Can you send a boat to Algeria and get me out of here? While he's doing this, he's communicating with his very good friend John Lennon, who I always like saying this because it makes for a good story, but happens to be true. Lennon was such a big fan of Leary back in the late 60s, beginning in the late 60s, that he wrote a song called Come Together that was really for Timothy Leary. And it was based in part on Tim Leary's campaign. Tim had run kind of a semi-serious, semi-absurd run for the governorship of California, and his slogan was, you know, why do we come together? He mentioned it to John Lennon, and Lennon wrote this song called Come Together.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How was Tim Leary, you know, the Panthers wanted money in exchange for protecting him.
Yes.
Where was he getting money all this time?
Well, you know, John Lennon was one example. I'll tell you what. Every once in a while, when you're doing some research, there's something that runs through you like electricity. A large part of our book is based on Timothy Leary's archives. Thousands and tens of thousands of bits of ephemera and documents and postcards and hard to figure out things that he had jotted down on cocktail napkins. They're all in the possession of the New York Public Library. A couple of years ago, the folks who were controlling Tim's estate sold this unbelievable, important, historic batch of archival material to the New York Public Library. So with Steve, my buddy, we flew up to New York and spent a lot of time in the old New York City Public Library, the famous one in Midtown Manhattan. It looks like something out of Hogwarts, you know, mm-hmm. the way a library really should look. And I open up one box, and there's a letter in it that says to Timothy Leary, and it's from John Lennon. And I guess that's the fanboy, the authentic fanboy part of me there. I'm going, oh my goodness. Should
touching
I be,
a piece of
yeah,
paper.
Should I be holding this? Yeah, should I? Someone take a picture of me holding this document? But he had sent $5,000 to Tim while Tim was on the run on the lam. And there were other people who were supporting him. Allen Ginsberg, the great, you know, I call him really the poet laureate maybe of the counterculture. And there were other people, the playwright Arthur Miller. Tim had legions of fans, people who were willing not just to support him, you know, publicly with statements of affirmation, but to send him money and to keep him funded. And then very quietly, this really interesting group of drug-smuggling hippies called the Brotherhood of Eternal Love were also funneling money to him. Every once in a while, they would show up where Tim was in Algeria and then later on in Europe, where Tim went to, where Tim fled to after escaping the Black Panthers. They would just sort of mysteriously show up, oftentimes with a boot, literally a boot with a false bottom in the heel that would have a lot of drugs or money in it, or a briefcase filled with tons and tons of cash. And then Tim would stay on the loose for a few more weeks and even a few more months.
Did Nixon's guys know where he was all this time?
Yeah, that's something. For a while, they didn't. But then what became kind of clear, not to go to another pop culture reference in terms of movies, but it was sort of like the great eye of Sauron in Lord of the Rings. They were very well aware of where he was and could sort of see him through the CIA. The precursor of the Drug Enforcement Agency, Bureau of Narcotics, and then just embassy workers whose mission it had been find Timothy Leary. So constant reports, we began seeing these in Tim's FBI files and State Department files. He was being monitored all the time. And you know, when I had met Tim, at that time, was unaware of all this. He was trying to figure out, how did they know where I was at every minute?
My guest is author Bill Minutaglio. We're talking about his new book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
Like a
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That, of course, was the Beatles singing Come Together, a song that John Lennon wrote for Timothy Leary. Bill Minnetaglia, don't understand what that song means, even though now I know I have some context for it. But my guest is Bill Minnetaglia. We're talking about his book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. We're going to almost skip over the time that Leary was also in Switzerland being protected by this mysterious playboy who had an ulterior motive, because I want to get to how he was ultimately captured. He was in Afghanistan because the Swiss would not extradite.
Yeah, exactly. Nixon sent then Attorney General John Mitchell to Switzerland to strong arm the Swiss into getting them to boot Leary out. And they wouldn't budge. The argument, in part, was that he was an intellectual, a public intellectual. He had a lot to offer to the world, and that he shouldn't be just cast into a system back in the United States that many people thought had been ginned up to put him in jail again forever. So Tim was faced with an unusual dynamic. He was actually enjoying life, you know, in Europe. He was hanging out with Andy Warhol, and you know, trying to reestablish connections again to the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and living kind of the high life. Folks in France, Switzerland, and other parts of Europe had adopted him and seemed to have, you know, broadly speaking, a more enlightened view of Tim and his contributions. So a lot of musicians and artists and even political leaders were gravitating toward him. But that said, Nixon kept turning up the burners. He got it to number 11 on the burner. And it seemed as if the Swiss finally caved in and said, well, okay, I think he's going to have to leave. If not to the United States, he's just going to have to leave Switzerland. So he took a little jog to Austria, where a lot of unusual things occurred. And while there, with some friends who were quite charismatic, quite interesting, and very, very colorful, some of them very, very wealthy, they decided that, well, we could go to India, we could go to Sri Lanka, other parts of South Asia, Southeast Asia even, but maybe we should go to Afghanistan. Today, it seems probably not
poor advice.
The most wise choice. Back then, and this is late 1972, early 1973.
It's a very different place then.
Exactly. It could be considered more benign. And it was on kind of what some people call the hippie highway. It was a place where if you were a, quote, seeker and someone who was into, using, you know, recreational drugs as a path to enlightenment, that you might pass through Afghanistan. The hashish there was powerful and plenty, and it was a far more open environment in terms of receptivity to visitors from the West. And so it was a place. In fact, a lot of Tim's friends from this aforementioned Brotherhood of Eternal Love had set up shop there because that's where they were scoring all their hashish, which they were smuggling in surfboards and sending back to the United States. They were filling up Volkswagen buses with hashish hidden away and then bringing it to the U.S. Tim said, Afghanistan it is, and that's where I'm going to go. And unfortunately for him, as we talked about earlier, he really was being monitored. I mean, he was his latitude and longitude were both very well known to the Nixon White House, to the State Department. And so when he landed in Afghanistan, Tim was under the impression that he was going to be given refuge by the king of Afghanistan, because the king's nephew had done a lot of LSD and was a big believer in Tim Leary. So he thought he had a, you know, safe harbor there, but it was really a trap. There was a trap waiting for him there, and he was busted in Afghanistan. Yeah,
he thought he was going to see, he was being taken to see the king.
He thought he was being taken to see the king, and that surely the king, being perhaps enlightened and maybe even in tune with the same kinds of quote royalty that Tim had been mingling with in Europe, would also see that he was a planetary citizen and not really a threat.
Did his recapture score Nixon any political points at home?
You know, I don't think it did, you know, really. And it might have solidified some of the resistance to Nixon, because I think people began looking at it and going, this is a man who was unnecessarily hounded around the world. And if he could be, you know, faulted, some critics of Tim would say, was that he opened up Pandora's box and then didn't have a way to really regulate or control. He didn't abide by his own thought of set and setting, particularly that maybe LSD had become this widespread recreational drug. You know, one of the big beefs that Tim might have had in his life was with the father of LSD, Albert Hoffman, a Swiss chemist, very serious-minded Swiss chemist, who is credited with discovering LSD.
Hoffman didn't know what would be made of LSD.
No, exactly. And Hoffman had inadvertently ingested some, and it irrevocably changed his life as well. But he really considered it somewhat tantamount to a sacrament and a really important medical tool. And he, we mentioned this in the book, had some famous summit meetings with Tim while Tim was on the lam in Europe. And he basically accused Tim, again, of opening up this box and it becoming less controlled, that it had gotten maybe more, it become a recreational thing as opposed to, you know, a serious path to enlightenment or even as a cure to some mental health issues. So, you know, the net effect was that I think the Nixon administration was very, very happy they had succeeded, but the ripple effect, you know, wasn't as big as they had hoped. They kept pushing and pushing. While Tim was on the lam, they declared him to be the biggest drug kingpin in the history of the United States. I mean, he was, you know, El Chapo squared, if you will, in the United States, the way Nixon was describing him. They also set for a while the highest bail ever in U.S. history on him, you know, and on and on and on. So the cards were really stacked up. And in terms of, you know, what the true effect was of quote, you know, bringing him to heel, it was hard to prove that it was a big success.
So people were divided over whether he was a hero or an anti-hero.
Yep.
Did he have anything important to say, Bill?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, and again, I did meet him, and maybe he, you know, practiced some wonderful Lyrian mind control on me.
You didn't leave your drink unattended at any point,
well,
right?
We shared a few cool beverages. We were at an old cool bar in Houston, but, you know, when you really, you know, dial it back and look at what he was saying and preaching, he was somewhat consistent. And I think he became a bit of a cork in a raging river. He was just gusted or moved forward by political circumstances that he didn't want. And you know, he managed to always be buoyant. But I think what got drowned along the way were some of the things that he was really saying and advocating, which really boiled down to empathy, to understanding, to continuing to be curious, to look at ways to heal people that hurt, to diminish your ego. You know, that was one of his big mantras, kill your ego. And it's one of the things that attracted John Lennon to him initially. And John was trying to work through that as he got more and more famous. And so he was attracted to some of Leary's philosophies. So, yeah, I think if you can, you know, pull away from the polarization or the demonization that was visited on him and look a little bit at what he was advocating, you know, it's a little like the old, was it the Elvis Costello song, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding? It seems maybe quaint now, and we view him through a weird nostalgic prism, but I think the things he was advocating were certainly sound. By the way, on a scientific level, you can pick up copies of Wired magazine and other you know, publications that, you know, suggest that they're looking at the new thing, the new way of approaching things, and even how ideas and creativity are spawned. And you'll see that there are a lot of people talking about using LSD in microdosing to improve creativity. And then, yeah, to address mental illnesses. We were pleasantly surprised, I suppose, as we were working on our book, I had a Google News feed set up for the word LSD. That probably alarmed a lot of my coworkers and my family, but it was for, you know, to keep pace with what people were thinking about this drug that at one time was considered an anathema, the worst, you know, poison imaginable. But it's in the news so often now as a palliative and as a cure, and I would call him, you know, prescient in that regard as well.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Was Timothy Leary a drug addict or a drug abuser?
Well, I guess, you know, I'm going to sound like a politician now, and it all depends. I don't think he was a drug abuser. He was an advocate of using drugs, as I said, to a path of awareness and enlightenment, and that if you misused them, you know, again, you broke the rules. You weren't in the right mindset. Maybe you were pressured into it. You were unwillingly participating in the adventure. Then bad things could happen. So he really believed in the set and setting again. Now, whether he could have done more to control all of that, that's probably a different discussion. You know, I'll tell you this. I was speaking about Stephen, my brilliant co-author, again, and I were speaking in Houston, and we took some questions from the audience. We were talking about our book, and there was a guy there who said, you know, I'm the guy who was responsible for shooting Timothy Leary's ashes into outer space. I said, no, okay, we did mention it in our book at the very end. And I said, well, pray tell, you're more interesting than we are. And he said that at the latter end of Tim's life, he had wanted to have his ashes shot into outer space, which you actually can do. There's a guy in Houston who'll do it for you. But he seemed to suggest to me that it was Tim's idea of a great existential joke that his ashes they were shot into outer space, along with the ashes of Gene Roddenberry, by the way, the inventor of Star Trek.
Same flight?
Same flight. And that the idea on Tim's part, perhaps, was that as the canister holding his ashes would re-enter Earth's atmosphere, the canister itself might burn up, but that Tim's ashes would then float down on us, and that some of Tim's own molecules, which perhaps were defined by the hundreds and hundreds of trips he had taken on LSD, that we'd be breathing in Tim Leary's molecules, and maybe we are right now. I don't know, in this studio. We'll see. But I think, you know, he was really preaching about love and peace and harmony. And I know it sounds at times when you say those words like the trio of naivete, but that's really what he was all about.
So he died more than 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Did he know at that point? Did you know at that point that you would write about him someday?
I always wanted to write about him. What was super cool for me was when I met him, he gave me his phone number. And I thought, well, that's probably not a real phone number. You know, I looked at it to make sure that all the proper number of digits were there. Yeah, right, exactly. I say, well, that's a 14-number phone number. But I wound up calling it and then calling it again and again. And it just used to surprise me that I dial a number. This was in fact, I was calling from Dallas, where I was living at the time, often out to L.A., Los Angeles, where he was living. He would answer the phone. This is Timothy Leary. And then we'd have these, you know, interesting conversations for a few more hours. I can't claim to have been, you know, great friends with him. Of course not. But really interesting things. And I what he told me, and he's told other people, was that I don't want to be known as a druggie, you know, a drug advocate. I was labeled the king of LSD, and that's what Richard Nixon thought of me. But I really wanted to look at ways that we could all communicate in a better, more humane fashion.
The new book by Bill Minutaglio and Stephen L. Davis is called The Most Dangerous Man in America: Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. Bill, thanks for taking us on this trip with you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for letting me go with you.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.